Okay, I'm going to pick up where we left off in Proverbs chapter 28. Okay, is everyone there? Okay, Solomon writes, "The wicked flee when no one is pursuing, but the righteous are as bold as a lion." I think I've mentioned this when we're going through some of these other Proverbs, how if you've got a guilty conscience, chances are you're going to be always looking over your shoulder. Just bring it down to where we live and breathe. I think every one of us has this experience. I mean, I have it virtually every single day, you know, driving down the road and you might see a cop and what's your first response? I mean, for me, I said, I take my lead foot off the gas pedal, right? Why? Because, you know, you see him because, you know, you're fudging, you know, you're going over the line, but that's for something that's very, very common. But what I'm saying, if you do something against the law or something wicked, well, then you're always going to be looking over your shoulder, and every time you see a cop, you parked outside your house or whatever. Yeah.
But John here it says that the wicked man flees. Aren't you supposed to step on the gas pedal?
Yeah. Well, we're talking about all through this book, we're talking about fools, right? Well, when the cops are pursuing somebody, a wicked person, I mean, he takes off running. I mean, it just shows absolute foolishness. But what it's talking about here is when no one is pursuing them because of their guilty conscience. But what we're going to see as far as the climax of this is, I think it's pretty interesting to me, is when Jesus Christ comes back, when he returns. And I was just giving a talk up there at the retreat this past weekend about, you know, basically the second coming of Christ and the end of the world. But what Isaiah had said, what the wicked are going to do, in Isaiah chapter 2, verse 10, it says, "Enter the rocks and hide in the dust from the terror of the Lord, from the splendor of his majesty. The proud look of man will be abased, and the loftiness of man will be humbled, and the Lord alone will be exalted in that day." And he goes on to say, "Men will go into the caves of the rocks and into the holes of the ground before the terror of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty when he arises to make the earth tremble. In that day men will cast away to the moles and to the bats their idols of silver and their idols of gold which they made for themselves to worship in order to go into the caverns of the rocks and the clefts of the cliffs before the terror of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty when he arises to make the earth tremble." And basically, John said the same thing in chapter 6 of Revelation. When he said this, the sky was split apart like a scroll, and when it was rolled up, and every mountain and island were moved out of its places, and the kings of the earth, and the great men, and the commanders, and the rich, and the strong, and every slave and free man hid themselves in the caves and among the rocks of the mountains. And they said to the mountains and to the rocks, "Fall on us and hide us from the presence of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb, for the great day of their wrath has come, and who is able to stand?" You know what? That's what I'm saying. At the very end of the world, I mean, you're going to see the wicked who have just been at war with God their whole life long, and then when they see Christ coming back, they are going to be absolutely terrified, and they are definitely going to be fleeing. They're going to be so terrified that, can you imagine, they'll be pleading to the rocks and the mountains and the hills to just crush them into oblivion rather than in order to hide them from the face of God. I mean, most people don't even want to think about that, or they would just smile, you know, laugh at that or scoff at that ain't going to happen. But I'm telling you, that's going to be the ultimate of this verse 28, when the wicked flee before the presence of an angry God. That's what's going to happen at the very end. But he also says the righteous are as bold as a lion. Well, that's the thing. You know, if you got a clear conscience, what are the righteous going to do when they see him coming back? I mean, they have gone through so much as far as the tribulation is concerned, but then when they see Christ coming, they're going to be having tears of joy streaming down their faces. They're going to be saying, "Praise God, hallelujah, here he comes." I mean, they're not going to be trying to hide from Christ at all, because they're right with God. And when we're right with God, then we got nothing to fear. And he also says that verse 2, he says, "By the transgression of a land, many are its princesses, but by a man of understanding and knowledge, so it endures." This says a lot to me. It really does. Because when it says, "By the transgression of a land, many are its princes," what that suggests to me is that when there's a great deal of sin and wickedness and ungodliness within the land, well, what do you see in your leadership? Who do you see running the country? I mean, our leaders are nothing more than a reflection of our people. That's it. And our people are a reflection of our leaders. And that's why we don't have hardly any good leadership today, because there's hardly any fear of God in the country. So you see a bunch of leaders that are running this country who have no fear of God. And what's the byproduct of fearing God?
Wisdom.
Wisdom. That's it. That's why, you know, fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. That's, I mean, if we fear God, then our fear of God means that we recognize our accountability to him. Therefore, we live our lives accordingly. That's fear of God. That's fear of the Lord. And so, if there's no fear of God in basically the country or the nation, then you're going to see no fear of God as far as leadership is concerned. That's what it's saying here. By the transgression of a land, many are princes are just put down as politicians. But by a man of understanding and knowledge, so it endures. That's the only thing that's going to enable this country to endure, is to have people with what? Understanding and knowledge. But it's spiritual understanding, because go back to Isaiah chapter 1, it lists the seven spirits of God: spirit of the Lord, spirit of wisdom, spirit of knowledge, spirit of strength, spirit of counsel, the spirit of the fear of the Lord, and spirit of understanding and knowledge. I mean, these are spirits. And if you have a person who's committed to God, well, you're going to have understanding, you're going to have knowledge. That's the only thing that's going to make this country endure. But just look around. If anybody has any perspective at all, looking at our history, we know that this country's on its way out. This country's on its way down. I mean, this country is not improving. This country is imploding in every way. Militarily, economically, socially, spiritually. We are just on our way out. That's what it means here. Because why? We don't have anybody with understanding and insight and knowledge running anything. In verse 3, it says, a poor man who oppresses the lowly is like a driving rain, which leaves no food.
Does your verse 3 say a poor man?
A poor man who oppresses the lowly is like a driving rain which leaves no food. What is your translation?
It just says a ruler here.
Yeah.
But that's all right.
Okay. Did anybody else's translation say anything different?
A ruler who oppresses the poor.
Yeah, a ruler. But what I think the suggestion is, which you take these different translations together, is a ruler who comes up from poor roots, or a ruler who comes up from the rank and file. Who do you see like this? You see Stalin was like this, Lenin was like this, Hitler was like this, I think Mussolini was like that, Mao Zedong was like that. You look at their lineage, you look at their stock, you look at their genealogy, and all I'm saying is this. Very often these people come up from the rank and file, they tell everybody, look, we're going to make a difference because all these rich fat cats are running the show and we're going to take over. And what happens when very often they take over? You know, so many of the poor people put their hope in this up-and-coming world leader, or ruler, or politician, or president, or king, or whatever, and then he ends up showing his true colors in the end. And what happens here? It says, a poor man or ruler who oppresses the lowly is like a driving rain which leaves no food. Well, what that suggests is rain is something you need, something you want. But a driving rain, what is a driving rain? Yeah, it's just an overwhelming flood. And so instead of being able to water your crops and to give you a future, it just washes everything away. Well, that's what happens when a lot of these despots and a lot of these butchers become leaders. And verse 4 says, those who forsake the law praise the wicked, but those who keep the law strive with them. Now, that's a straightforward statement that Solomon's making. But it says a lot. It says an awful lot. Because it says, those who forsake the law praise the wicked. God's laws. Okay? It says, those who forsake the law praise the wicked. We've got so many people in our government today who are wicked. Now, they would never consider themselves to be wicked, and they never admit to being wicked. And they never even see themselves as being wicked. But in the eyes of God, they're wicked, because what are they doing? They are promoting the very things that are an offense to God, that are an affront to God, that trample underfoot His laws, His statutes, His ordinances, right? That's what they're doing. But it says here, but those who keep the law strive with Him. And we're getting more and more in a situation where the more the wicked get control of power, the more it's going to be a situation that we will see unfold where the righteous who strive with this wickedness are going to be labeled as enemies of the state. You can see it in past history. You don't have to look that far back to see it. We're becoming less and less, as far as numbers are concerned, of people who are standing up and striving against the wicked. But now that the wicked are becoming so powerful, they're getting to the point now where they're just going to silence. They're going to silence all opposition. It's coming. I see it. It's coming. And then in verse 5 it says, evil men do not understand justice, but those who seek the Lord understand all things. Now when it says evil men do not understand justice, 2 Samuel chapter 22, and as a matter of fact, it's also Psalm 18. This is what David wrote in 2 Samuel chapter 22. He said this, with the kind you, that's God, with the kind you show yourself kind, with the blameless you show yourself blameless, and with the pure you show yourself pure, and with the perverted you show yourself astute, or basically perverse. Now, what does that mean? It's like God, what he's saying here is that to the kind person, they see God as being kind. To the blameless person, they see God as being blameless. To the pure person, they see God as being pure. But then to the crooked person, to the wicked person, it says here that God shows himself to be twisted or astute. And what I mean is this. The righteous person, they can see the righteousness of God's judgments. They could see it. A wicked person is just going to turn around and shake their fist in God's face and not see God's righteousness in this. I mean, I've seen it many, many times, and probably you guys have seen it and heard it over the years too. You ever hear a person say, hey, if God is so good, then how come this disaster happened, or that disaster happened, or this happened, or that happened? I don't care whether it's a tornado, a flood, or cancer, or whatever. Throw it out there. If God is so good, how come this happened? Now, when a person says that, analyze what they're saying.
If I were God, I wouldn't do that.
And so what's the bottom? What are they really saying?
That I'm more righteous than God.
Exactly. Exactly. Whenever a person questions what God does, what they're really saying, and when you get cut through all the smoke and the claptrap and everything else, what they're really saying is, you know what, I'm more righteous than God, because I would have never allowed this to happen. All right? But God, in his infinite wisdom, has an infinite number of reasons why he has allowed that to happen. But then, too, when it talks about here, it says here, evil men do not understand justice. Well, I'll tell you right now, and I've said it many times over the years, there's a lot in this Bible that I do not want to believe. I do not want to believe it. I would love to be able to just tell you something different than what it says. One thing I do not want to believe is an eternal hell. There's no way I want to believe in that. Absolutely no way. And there's a lot of people who feel just like that, but what they do is they will torture God's word, or they would edit it out and say, well, there's no such thing. Or they will spiritualize it, saying, well, it's just a soul sleep, it's just an unconsciousness, or hell is on earth. Throw it out there. I've heard it all before. And all I'm saying is this, no? When you look at it from what God says, and Christ spoke about hell more than anyone, and let me just ask you something, just use some common sense. If there's no hell, what did Jesus Christ die to save us from? It wasn't the grave, because the sinner dies right along with the saint. I mean, and so, but the righteous person can begin to see the justice of God even in that. As much as they don't want to believe in it, they accept it, and they see God's wisdom in it. And then he says here, but those who seek the Lord understand all things. Now, I think that that's kind of significant too, because when we went through 1 Corinthians, Paul talked about the spirit of man understands the man. And what he means by that is this. Only the person themselves know exactly what they're thinking. So what I'm driving at here is that Paul says in Corinthians that the spirit of man is the only one that knows exactly what the man is really thinking. And he talks about the spirit of God and how the spiritual man can really connect with God's spirit and see where God is coming from. And that's why when you read this here, he talks about evil men do not understand justice, but those who seek the Lord understand all things. If we seek God, put God first in our life, we have an insight, we have an understanding that connects with God, and we can see things where men are not in a position to be our judge, because we can judge all things correctly because we have the Spirit of God within us. And he says in verse 6, he says, better is the poor man who walks in his integrity than he who is crooked, though he be rich. Better is the poor man who walks in his integrity. In other words, a poor man who's honest, who's trustworthy, who's a man of his word, you can depend upon him, right? You're going to live a life that even if you don't have money or a lot of money, you're going to be at peace. You're at peace with God, you're at peace with other people, and you're going to enjoy life more. You take a man like this Madoff who ripped more people off and probably was the biggest rip-off artist in history. $65 billion he ripped people off. I mean, you wonder, well, how did that happen? He ripped off all the rich, all the famous, all these pension funds, all these different things. All right, but I'm willing to bet he didn't sleep too good at night because he could see where this was leading. That once you start this Ponzi scheme, I mean, now you got this ball rolling. You got to keep it going in order to keep your head above water. You got to keep this lie going. You got to perpetrate this to keep it going, to keep the scam going, because once it begins to unravel, I mean, you're going to jail. That's what happened to him. And in verse 7 it says, he who keeps the law is a discerning son, but he who is a companion of gluttons humiliates his father. You know, he who keeps the law is a discerning son. Well, what law? It's God's law. We keep God's law, then we show discernment. And he says it's your discerning son, because how many times have I said, going through the Proverbs, because it's almost an underlying theme that just basically says, you know what, you're going to reap exactly what you sow. If you're going to sow to the wind, you're going to reap the whirlwind. Whatever we sow in life, we're going to end up reaping. So if we sow the right seed, then we're a discerning person. If we follow God's laws and obey God's laws and do our utmost to follow Him and obey Him, then we're going to reap what we sow, and we're going to reap a lot of positive results. But He says here, he who is a companion of gluttons humiliates his father. That says a lot too, because we're talking about the early church fathers. They had the seven, they listed basically the seven deadly sins. Anybody know what they were?
Pride, greed, anger, lust, envy, gluttony, and sloth.
Good, good.
Wow.
Yeah, good. You got it down. All right? It was pride and lust and envy and anger and greed and slothfulness and gluttony. All right? And the early church fathers basically made that list up, and they said it was the seven deadly sins. I mean, basically all other sins can fall under that in some way, shape, or form. And I think it's interesting that Solomon talks about laziness, slothfulness, he talks about drunkenness, and here he talks about gluttony. He talks about it several different times. He talks about envy and anger and pride. He talks about all these things. Yeah, I mean, you can go through the book of Proverbs and find the seven deadly sins. I mean, he talks about them over and over and over again. But when he says he was a companion of gluttons, here's what we're talking about. We were talking about it before the Bible study. How important it is to get plugged in with the right crowd, with the right people. Let's just say everybody went up to that retreat and they rededicated their life to Christ, or they committed their life to Christ for the very first time. If they don't get plugged in with the right fellowship consistently, all right, to get plugged into a Bible study, get plugged into a fellowship, get plugged into around people, get around people who are godly, who know God, that's the only way you're going to be able to really grow. But I've said it so many times, you want to you hang around with criminals, I'll see you behind bars. You're going to hang around with drug addicts, well, that's what you're going to become. You're going to be hang around with the immoral, that's what you're going to become. Throw it out. What kind of company do you keep? And here he's talking about the companion of gluttons humiliates his father. Well, this is a self-indulgent person. And it doesn't just even have to be food. It's an excess of where, let's just change that word. You can change this word to a number of things, and it could still say the same thing. But he was a companion of, let's say, drunkards, or he was a companion of drug addicts. That's a good one, because there's so many people today who get hooked on drugs. And if you're a companion of drug addicts, guess what? What's going to happen? He humiliates his father, because this type of person who gets into drugs and they start feeding their habit, what do they start doing? They start stealing. They start lying. They start cheating. They start doing everything they can to feed their habit. They'll cut their own mother's throat for a nickel. After a while, I mean, these people are just an absolute humiliation to their parents. And how I've seen it time and time and time and time again. Now, where so many times you see grandparents having to raise their kids' kids because their kids get into drugs, their kids go to jail, go to the prison, their kids' whole life is just shipwrecked because of gluttony or drunkenness or drug abuse, the whole thing. In other words, the whole life is just centered around self-indulgence. And he says in that verse 8, says, he who increases his wealth by interest in usury gathers it for him who is gracious to the poor. Going back to Exodus chapter 22, God had basically said that you weren't to lend money to your brother at the interest, that you were to help him out in his need, basically. But God did allow you to charge interest for the alien or in a business transaction. But here it says, he who increases his wealth by interest in usury. Well, you can apply that a lot of different ways. I mean, look at a situation where every time there's a crisis, he who increases his wealth by interest or usury, well, that's what these people do. They just take advantage of people to the point where they just basically can ruin a person, ruin their life, ruin their business, ruin so many things. And what drives it? It's a deadly sin. What drives it?
Greed.
It's a deadly sin, right?
Hidden by ambition.
Right. And that we were just talking about. You go through the book of Proverbs and you will see it over and over and over again, the seven deadly sins that are mentioned one way, shape, or form or another. And that greed, what's going to happen? He gathers it for him who is gracious to the poor. In other words, in the end, this guy is going to end up doing what? He's going to have to count to God for his life and for what he's done to other people. And who's he gathering his money for? In the end, other people are going to get it. In verse 9, it says, he who turns away his ear from listening to the law, even his prayer is an abomination. And that says a lot, too. It really does. If you stop and analyze this, he who turns away his ear from listening to the law, even his prayer is an abomination. You know what that suggests strongly? It's a person who's not living for God. All right, he's not obeying God. He's not following God. But he's a religious person. Because what? He says, well, I pray. Or I go to church. Or maybe twice a year. Or even if he goes once a week. I don't know how many times I've talked to people over the years who have no connection really with God in the concrete. It's just always in the abstract. Always some ivory tower where they talk about God. And they'll say, well, I pray. But they're not obeying God. They're not following God. You get what I mean? And some people are just flat out living lives that are just utterly contrary to his will. Well, this is what it says here. He who turns away his ear from listening to the law, even his prayer is an abomination to God. It's not that his prayer is just ineffective. His prayer is an abomination. And that says a lot, doesn't it? Because what would you think of a person who always smiled to your face and always sang your praises, but behind your back, they were always stabbing you in the back, always speaking ill of you, always stealing from you, always ripping you off. But to your face, they were smiling to your face and always praising you. I mean, you have a lot more respect for somebody who just would, you know, spit in your face. I would, right? Well, this is what these people do to God. If they're not obeying God, but they go to church and they say that they pray, it's not just that their prayers are ineffective. Their prayers are an abomination. He says in verse 10, it says, he who leads the upright astray in an evil way will himself fall into his own pit, but the blameless will inherit good. Here we also see, what do we see? That underlying thing, reaping what you sow. He who leads an upright astray in an evil way will himself fall into a pit. Well, Jesus Christ said something similar to this. He said, man, if somebody misleads a little one who believes in me, it'd be better if he had a millstone tied around his neck and cast into the depths of the sea. Now, if you have a millstone, which is usually about a 2-ton stone, and you got that tied around your neck and you're cast into the sea, you're as good as dead. You're going straight to the bottom. You'll never see the light of day again. But Jesus said, it'd be better if that happened to you, suggesting that there's something even worse than death, which is obviously hell, yeah. Right? So basically he's saying the same, Jesus said the same thing that this verse 10 is saying. But he also says, but the blameless will inherit good. Again, reaping what you sow. You know, if we are blameless before God, then we're going to inherit good. Well, what's an inheritance? It's something you don't see right up front, but eventually it comes to you. And good will come to us if we continue to obey God. And verse 11 says, the rich man is wise in his own eyes, but the poor who has understanding sees through him. You know, that's so true. The rich man is wise in his own eyes. What happens to a rich man very often that makes him wise in his own eyes?
Thinks he made his money on his own by his own smarts, and, you know, none of it was, you know, maybe luck or a blessing from God. He thinks he did it all himself.
Yeah, and not only that, but here's the thing about riches. Is that very often it makes a person feel autonomous from God. Or in other words, it makes a person feel independent from God. It makes a person, they don't feel dependent upon God. I live by Proverbs 3:5. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Don't rely upon your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him and He will direct your path. But I tell you right now, if I won the lotto, and let's just say I had $1 million or more, and then I needed a car, which as a matter of fact I do, well, I would hope that I would pray about it. Alright? Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Don't rely upon your understanding. All right, now I would hope that I would pray about it. But a rich person, is he going to pray about it if he needs a car? No, he's wise in his own eyes. He's just going to go out and slap down the money. But a person, I think, that even if they have money, they live by that proverb, trust in the Lord with all your heart. Don't rely upon your understanding. Then they're going to pray about it. But here's the thing about the rich man. Jesus said it's easier for a camel to go through an eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. Because rich people don't see their need as well as a poor person may see his need as far as their spiritual life is concerned, as far as their dependence upon God is concerned. I mean, I see people like this. One time I was witnessing to a salesman at work, and he was just mocking the things of God, just mocking the whole thing. I mean, I couldn't get to first base with him. And then I just flat out said to him, you know what, you couldn't take your next breath apart from God. And he says, oh yeah, watch me. And I thought, well, you know, there you go. There's a fool for you, you know. And if he starts turning blue, he'll give God a second thought. But, you see, this person just feels totally independent from God. I don't need God, right? Well, that's very often what will happen to rich people. They don't see their need. He says, but a poor man who has understanding sees through him, right? You can see right through. This guy, you take away his wealth, he's nothing. He's nobody. He's finished. He's through. In verse 12, it says, when the righteous triumph, there is great glory. But when the wicked rise, men hide themselves. That says a lot to me, too. Especially the second part, when the wicked rise, men hide themselves. And look what happens, like, for example, when the communists took over. They took over, obviously, in Russia, and then they took in China, and then in Cuba, and they took in Vietnam and Cambodia. Just go down the line. All the millions upon millions of people that ended up being under the scourge of communism. Well, people who used to, let's say, gather together, for example, like in Russia, where they would go to churches, all right, or in China, where they would go to church. Well, what happened to them when the wicked took over? Just read it right here. But when the wicked rise, men hide themselves. Like what we're doing right now. Fortunately, we live in a country where we are allowed to do this. But I see the handwriting on the wall more and more, because we get more and more wicked people that are running this country. And once we're beyond that tipping point, which I believe we're getting there real quick, there's going to be a situation where this group here is going to be called hate crime, a hate crime, for no other reason than we're just simply saying what God has said on certain issues. And they're going to say, well, you're just preaching hate, and we're going to shut you down. That's coming. But people will just scoff at that, mock at that, saying it's never going to happen, never going to happen. I say, amen. Look back on history, and I can guarantee you they said that in Russia. They said that in Cuba. They said that in China. They said that everywhere that the wicked took over, and then they lost their freedom of speech. They said that it would never happen to them. And I'm telling you, it's going to happen here. Right? And then what will happen? The righteous will have to hide themselves. They'll have to go underground. They'll have to meet in secret. And verse 13 says, he who conceals his transgressions will not prosper, but he who confesses and forsakes them will find compassion. Now that says so much. He who conceals his transgressions will not prosper. Look at this nation. Is this nation prospering? Okay, what is our major transgression that we conceal? What is it?
It's abortion.
It is.
It's legal.
It is. That's ground zero. We have murdered almost 15 million unborn children, and people hate me for even bringing it up, but I'm just simply saying, if it wasn't for that heinous sin, God would, I think, I'm convinced, God would be far, 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 far more merciful to us if it wasn't for that one crime. But we keep, you know, what do? We justify it, we rationalize it, we excuse it, all right? But this is what David said, how blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. How blessed is the man whom the Lord does not impute iniquity, and in whose spirit there is no deceit. Now listen to this, when I kept silent about my sin, my body wasted away. I'm just going to paraphrase this. When we kept silent about our sin, our country wasted away. I said, through my groanings all day long, for day and night your hand was heavy upon me. Or just, for day and night your hand was heavy upon this country. My vitality was drained away as with the fever heat of summer. Is our vitality, our strength being drained away as a nation? And he says, I acknowledge my sin to you, and my iniquity I did not hide. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave the guilt of my sin. Now, when David was basically kept silent about his sin in regards to Bathsheba, his body wasted away, his immune system just turned on him, he couldn't sleep at night, until finally he just came clean, came to the Lord and said, man, I really, really have blown it. And just begged God for forgiveness, because basically what David says is that God wasn't looking for sacrifices and for animal sacrifices, but for a broken, contrite spirit. And that's what it's going to take, a broken, contrite spirit before God, if we're going to find forgiveness both individually and collectively as a nation. And then he says here, in verse 14, how blessed is the man who fears always, but he who hardens his heart will fall into calamity. You know, that says a lot too. How blessed is the man who fears always. What does that mean?
Always keeps in mind that God's watching and aware of the things we do.
Yeah, well, if you fear always, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So you fear God. In other words, you recognize I have to be accountable to God. Right? You have to recognize that. And if you feel tempted to steal something or feel tempted to do something that's going to be dishonoring to God, then if you fear always, then what's going to happen? It says here, how blessed is man who fears always, but he who hardens his heart will fall into calamity. In other words, just take David's sin of adultery. He was a man who loved God with all his heart, right? That's what the Bible says. But then little incremental steps at a time, little things happened in his life where when the temptation arose, he didn't fear always. In other words, if he really feared God, he said, man, I really want that woman. Man, look at her. She's just a knockout. I just want her so bad. But if he really feared God, he would have turned on his heel and walked away from it. But he fell right into that temptation because he failed to fear God at that particular critical moment in his life. And what happened to him? He fell into that sin, and then to cover up his sin, he committed murder, and then what happened? He brought such calamity into his life, such judgment into his life, and that's what it's talking now about here. He who hardens his heart will fall into calamity. If we hell-bent are just doing our own way rather than obeying God, we're just going to end up shipwrecked. In verse 15, it says, like a roaring lion and a rushing bear is a wicked ruler over a poor people. And we basically read the same thing. Look at that verse 3. A poor man who oppresses the lowly is like a driving rain which leaves no food. And look at this verse 15. It's just reiterating itself. Like a roaring lion and a rushing bear is a wicked ruler over a poor people. That's almost poetic. What's the symbol for Russia? A bear, right? like a roaring lion and a rushing bear is a wicked ruler over a poor people. I mean, what is a roaring lion? What is a rushing bear? There's something to be really, you're terrified of, right? I mean, the people that came out of those camps and came out of that kind of oppression, it's interesting. When they got to this country, a lot of them who basically migrated here, they had such a hard time of opening up. Because they had a lifetime of being conditioned to don't say anything, don't open their mouth, always keep quiet, keep your eyes down. You know what I'm saying? They just weren't used to having that kind of freedom because of this kind of terror, this kind of oppression. Verse 16, he says, a leader who is a great oppressor lacks understanding, but he who hates unjust gain will prolong his days. Look at that. Look at how many leaders we've seen in history. All right. And just the past, 50, 60 years, we've seen so many. A leader who is a great oppressor lacks understanding. Look at how many of them. But you know what? What's coming? This world leader who's coming. And believe me, he's going to lack all spiritual understanding. And what's he going to do? He's going to end up bringing the whole world down. And he says here, but he who hates unjust gain will prolong his days. The suggestion here is a leader who lacks understanding. What does he do? He rules by unjust gain. He just rules by it, all right? By oppression, by robbery, by stealing. Look what happened when the communists took over there. I mean, they just confiscated people's land, their property. They killed people by the millions, literally by the millions, to steal everything that they had, all right? But he says here, but he who hates unjust gain will prolong his days. In verse 17, he says, a man who is laden with the guilt of human blood will be a fugitive until death. Let no one support him. Now, I'll paraphrase that. A country who is laden with the guilt of human blood will be a fugitive until death and let no one support him. And I know the pacifists, are going to say, we shouldn't be there. And I'm saying, no, that's not what it's saying. All right? Apply it to here. All right? Not to the military, apply it to here, our own country, your own life. Do you support this kind of thing? Well, believe me, anybody who supports this kind of thing, you're dripping with blood. And people hate me for saying it, but I'm saying, you know what? It's God who's going to say it in the end, not me. In verse 18, it says, he who walks blamelessly will be delivered, but he who is crooked will fall all at once. Again, what are you seeing here? You're seeing what? You're seeing reaping what you sow. He says, he who walks blamelessly. What does it mean to walk?
Make progress from one direction to another, going somewhere.
Yeah, that's what the Bible says so much about walking. And walking denotes making a definite progress in a definite direction. All right? He says, he who walks blamelessly. In other words, this is what characterizes your life. Every day, you are what? Blameless before God. It doesn't mean you're perfect, but what it means is we're really striving to obey God, follow God. That's what he says. Walks blamelessly will be delivered. Delivered from what?
Something that's worthy of being delivered from.
Delivered from all kinds of negative consequences, right? I mean, that if you're walking blamelessly, you're going to be delivered. If you go out there and rob a bank, you go out there and pickpocket up somebody's, rip people off left and right, well, you're not walking blamelessly, and consequently, you're going to end up in a slammer, you're going to end up in jail, you're going to end up in prison, you're going to end up in death row. Throw it out there. Well, for the blameless person, he's going to be delivered from all these negative consequences. That's why I say over and over again, look at the underlying theme, which is you reap what you sow, or that's what he's talking about here. But he who is crooked will fall at once. He may get away with a lot of wickedness for a long time, but in the end, he can come to ruin in an instant. And in verse 19 it says, he who tills his land will have plenty of food, but he who follows empty pursuits will have poverty and plenty. What is that saying? Again, it falls under the category of reaping what you sow. But what is it saying in essence?
Get up in the morning and go to work and do the right thing day
right.
after day.
Right. Yeah, you get up, you go to work, you put in an honest day's work and you keep doing it. Like I said, you do it day after day and week after week, month after month, year after year, decade after decade. And it doesn't sound like it's very enjoyable. And it isn't. But you keep doing it, and what's happened? You'll have plenty of food, right? But it says here, he who follows empty pursuits will have poverty and plenty. A person who follows empty pursuits is a person who's really lazy in his essence. And he feels like, well, I'm not going to get up every day and go to work because that's a drag. What I'm going to do is I want to make $1 million by investing in this or doing this or, being my own boss. That's a good one. No, I'm going to go out there and sell insurance. I'll be my own boss. That way I can play golf all day long and make a couple calls at night. You're going to end up in poverty because, you know what, if you're your own boss, now you really have to put in some hard hours if you're going to make a living, right? I'm saying? But you're following all these empty pursuits, right? Thinking you're going to get all these get-rich-quick schemes or all these these things that you're doing to try to convince yourself, well, I don't really have to work like a schmuck like all these other people. I could be smart and do this, that, and the other thing. And in the end, what, you're just going to come to poverty. And verse 20 says, a faithful man will abound with blessings, but he who makes haste to be rich will not go unpunished. Again, we'll repeat what you sow, right? A faithful man will abound with blessings. You could tie that 19 and 20 together, because a faithful man is what? He's going to get up every day and go to his job and put in an honest day's work and show this kind of integrity. And he says, but he who makes haste to be rich will not go unpunished. These two verses, 19 and 20, they're saying exactly the same thing, only in a different way. God's just reiterating himself for emphasis. In verse 21, it says, to show partiality is not good, because for a piece of bread, a man will transgress. Now, here we go. To show partiality is not good, right? And now, Solomon talks about bribes. He talks about bribes all the way through this, right? And this is what he's talking about. To show partiality is not good, because for a piece of bread, a man will transgress. And it's really talking about bribing. There are countries like in Africa, I was just reading a statistic over there, and it's like a country over there in Africa, you can't get anything done without first paying bribe money. Anything. But here in this country, we don't call it bribe money. I said it many, many times. It's special interest money. It's the same thing. You go up to a politician and say, hey, listen, here's some money for your next run on election of next election month. Well, we want you to vote this way. Now, is that a bribe money? You're just playing with words. It's just semantics. If this country really was serious about doing away with bribes, they'd do away with all special interest money, they'd do away with all lobbyists, all right? Just throw them all out under the air and say nobody's coming in there at all to try to persuade any legislator, any politician, any political leader in any way, shape, or form. This is what happens. Sure. He's talking about here. For a piece of bread, a man will transgress. I mean, a man will do anything to grease his palms. And we see it time and time and time again. How many times do we see it? Every year we see it. One politician after another is now being investigated for one thing or another because they can't keep their hands out of the till. And in verse 22, it says, a man with an evil eye hastened after wealth and does not know that want will come upon him. A man with an evil eye. What's an evil eye?
This version says stingy.
Okay. Anybody else's Bible say that? Mm-hmm. Huh?
Stingy.
Okay. A man with an evil eye hastens after wealth. I get the impression that it's a type of covetous eye. And we're talking about covetousness or envy. If you envy what somebody else has, because that's an evil eye, right? And hastens after wealth. And what happens? And does not know that want will come upon him. Because he's what? He's not out there going to make an honest day's living. Consequently, what's going to happen to him? Or even if you use a stingy eye. A stingy eye is like, hey man, you're not concerned about anybody else but yourself. All right? And what's going to happen to you? You're going to come to want. In verse 23 it says, he who rebukes a man will afterwards find more favor than he who flatters with the tongue. And here, how many times have we read something like this? Very, very similar going through the book of Proverbs. He who rebukes a man will afterwards find more favor than he who flatters with the tongue. But if you rebuke a man, what is absolutely essential that that man must have in order to appreciate your rebuke?
Humility.
Humility. You will not find a person who has a great deal of wisdom who's proud. You won't find it. Wisdom and humility go hand in hand. The wise person will step back and look at a rebuke and look at a reproof and say, you know, you're right. I appreciate you pointing that out. But like I said many times, our fallen nature does not take criticism well. But read it again. He who rebukes a man will afterwards find more favor than he who flatters with the tongue. Well, what is flattery?
Empty praise.
Yeah, it's empty praise. And like I said, look at how many times that people will try to corner Jesus by setting them up, you know, like, is it lawful to pay taxes or any other number of things? They were really trying to set him up to bring him down. But the way they would try to set him up is they use flattery to do it. Well, Jesus would see all, you know, right through that. But he says, then he who flatters with the tongue, meaning, man, a person who gives you false praise. I mean, it's far better to be given rebuke from a wise man than false praise from a fool. That's basically what it's saying. And in verse 24 says, he who robs his father or his mother and says, it is not a transgression, is the companion of a man who destroys. Now, here's the thing. How many parents today are being ripped off by their children because their children are either with the wrong crowd or they're doing drugs or doing something, you know, illegal, or and so they go into their house, get into their mom's purse or dad's wallet, or they start selling stuff on a pawn shop. It says here, this type of person says he's the companion of a man who destroys. It's just not that he's the companion of a man, you know, who is idle or does nothing, but this person is destructive. He's ruining people's lives. But he's saying here, he who robs his father or his mother and says, it is not a transgression. Now, if you're ripping your parents off and then somehow you justify it, how do you justify that in your mind when you say it's not a transgression?
Well, it's my parent.
Yeah.
I'll pay him back, or they owe me.
Right. Yeah, any number of things, right? And as far as God is concerned, you're a companion of a man who destroys. And in verse 25, it says, an arrogant man stirs up strife, but he who trusts in the Lord will prosper. Well, an arrogant man, this is a proud man. He stirs up strife, but he contrasts it with a man who trusts in the Lord. And like I said, Proverbs 3, 5 through 6, that's the proverb that I live by. That's the driving scripture of my life. To trust in the Lord with all your heart. Don't rely upon your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge Him, and He will direct your path. But it says here, an arrogant man stirs up strife. An arrogant man doesn't look to God. An arrogant man just feels like he knows all the answers. And he's going to definitely be in a situation where it's just going to cause strife and contention. Because he's not going to show a lot of wisdom, and people are going to try to oppose him as far as his stupidity is concerned. But very often they can't do anything about it. I mean, I can see this again and again and again with people that are in politics. And verse 26 says, he who trusts in his own heart is a fool, but he who walks wisely will be delivered. Now, that says a lot. That just speaks volumes. Because it says, he who trusts in his own heart is a fool. Why? Who can tell me?
Because the heart is deceitful.
Yeah. You go back to Jeremiah chapter 17. God says this, the heart is deceitful above all things. It's desperately wicked that nobody can know the true motives of the heart but God. Now, I have thought about that many, many times. I've meditated upon that, contemplated upon that over and over and over again for years. And I thought, you know what? That's the devil's greatest tool against us, is our own heart. Because our own heart can plead the purity of anything. Throw a sin out there. I don't care what sin it is. Our heart can somehow justify it, rationalize it, excuse it. It really can. I don't care what sin it is, because our heart is so deceitful. I mean, this is what the devil will use against it. Look at, for example, gay marriage. Now, it's because our heart is so deceitful and it's desperately sick or desperately wicked that we can go along and justify all this. And the devil is just using it as a tool to ruin us, to damn people. That's why it says here, he who trusts in his own heart is a fool. Well, this is what people are doing. They're trusting in their own heart. But he who walks wisely will be delivered. You know, if we follow God's laws and his commandments and walk wisely before him, that we fear God, that fear the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and we do it his way, he said, well, this is the mark God set up, and I'm not going to cross that boundary because that's his mark. That's his ancient boundary mark. Now you're going to walk in integrity, and you're going to be delivered from what? Being delivered from all kinds of consequences, right? And in verse 27, he who gives to the poor will never want, but he who shuts his eye will have many curses. Well, here's the thing. He who gives to the poor will never want. But I think we have to use discretion when it comes to giving to those who need. Because there's some people I wouldn't give a nickel to, even though they're poor. Right? Because what are they going to do? They're going to use it on drugs or get themselves drunk or do some, you know, thing to dishonor Christ with it. And I won't do it. But at the same token, I always go back to what God said in Deuteronomy. God said this, and it's very fascinating to me. He said, look, if you will obey me, if you will but obey me, there won't be any poor among you. And look at how many poor people we've got in this country and all over the world now. All right? But it always amazes me that there wouldn't be a poor person on earth if everybody obeyed God. Mm-hmm. But it was Jesus who said, basically, hey, the poor you always have with you. Because why? Because people aren't going to obey God. That's why. So he says here, he who gives to the poor will never want. Well, you have to use discretion. You have to use wisdom. And I think you really have to be prayerful about who you give to and what you give to and how much you give to. All right? To honor God. And that always needs to be a driving motive behind doing something for a needy person, is to extend that. But then we have to use discernment, we have to use wisdom. I really believe that strongly. Anyway, he who shuts his eyes will have many curses. In other words, look what happened to the rich man and Lazarus. That rich man was in a position where he could have helped Lazarus time and time and time and time again. But what did he do? He shut his eyes to this man's misery, to his poverty, to his pain, to his sickness. And Lazarus just longed to eat the crumbs that fell from the rich man's table. Now look where the rich man is. You know what I'm saying? And in the last verse, verse 28 says, when the wicked rise, men hide themselves. But when they perish, the righteous increase. Now, that's almost repeated itself, didn't it? Where it says, when the wicked rise, men hide themselves. And we were just talking about that earlier, right? That's what happens when the wicked take charge, that men hide themselves. Look at that verse 12. He says, when the righteous triumph, there is great glory. But when the wicked rise, men hide themselves. That's, you know, he's just saying it again, right here. God's repeating himself for emphasis. Yeah. Yeah. Right. You're right. Because why? When wicked men rise, then they become oppressive. And I'm telling you, it's coming to this country. When I really strongly believe that there's coming a day when we will no longer have the freedom to meet like this in this living room and read God's Word, that this will be outlawed and that I will be threatened with fines or imprisonment. And people will say, oh, no, not in this country. I say, amen, wake up, smell the coffee, look around, look what's happening. We are losing our freedoms left and right. Why? Because more and more wicked people are running this country. And we're beyond the tipping point now, and it's just a matter of time when people are going to be shut down under all kinds of these phony hate law crimes and all this fairness doctrine and everything else they're going to throw at you. Well, that's what's coming. He says, but when they perish, the righteous increase. All right? You know, you get rid of the wicked people, and what happens? You know, then righteousness begins to flourish. Anybody have anyone to add or share to what we read tonight?
Well,